Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 18th, 2003. Today's session is Education as a Mission Activity, Session 3 of Global Mission in the 21st Century, presented by Peter Nash, NAP 2003-08. Let's listen in.
Still, I think, for a few hours. And this is the third of three sessions on global mission, questions of solidarity, what mission is like in the 21st century. And today I'd like to talk about theological education as a missionary endeavor, missionary activity. I would bet only a third of BGM, the Mission Global Mission, which is the mission arm of the ELCA, are educational missionaries, and probably half of those are theological educators, people who earn at least a master's, usually a PhD in some theological field, taught for some time in the States or never taught in the States. And one of my former students went directly into the mission field after some adjunct teaching in the Chicago area. And he's coming back this year as well after 3 or 4, maybe 5 years in Mozambique with his family. His wife earned her PhD at the University of South Africa. The University of South Africa, which would have been Pretoria, I guess. It's not that important. She earned her PhD while she was teaching there, and they were actually, they're a clergy couple. He's Lutheran, she's Presbyterian, and it was a joint appointment, shared expenses and so on between the United Presbyterian Church USA and the ELCA, where they divided up their costs and salaries. So just another example of how mission lines are in many ways not as sharply drawn as they used to be. There's a fair amount of cooperation among the many churches, depending on the needs, both of the sending church and the receiving church, and of course the people whom we try to serve. I was, as you've heard over and over and over again by now, teaching in Brazil for 8 years, and I've had a fair amount of opportunity to move around the world. I've never been to Asia, but some of my good friends have. So, on the basis of some of their experience, some of the things that I've read, and some serious conversations last summer at the Summer Missionary Conference and the Summer Mission Apartments there. The ELCA has a set of about a dozen, goes up through I, so how many letters is that? 10 apartments for missionaries who are on home assignment in the States. From there, we do our interpretive work. If you've ever had a missionary, if your congregation is ever sponsored an ELCA missionary or an ALC missionary before that, probably they came from that spot in St. Paul, down the campus, on the edge of the campus of Luther Seminary, to your congregation to do their interpretive work, which we often refer to as the dog of Polisha. I joked a little bit yesterday about getting these letters from really sweet Sunday school kids asking about what it's like to be a missionary and save souls and tell people about Jesus, and I try to be nice, but it's just not in my nature. And I would write back and say, well, you know, I'm as far from the Amazon as you are from Alaska. The people here are the same people who are the Pennsylvania Dutch in Pennsylvania. And this particular letter was from Pennsylvania. And they're all Christians, and I'm helping them get ready to tell their congregations more about Jesus to help empower people to be what we call the priesthood of all believers. And it was sort of theological for a 6-year-old. I was hoping that his or her teacher could explain it. And they are really sweet. Some of them really do come from 6-year-olds. Some come from, you could tell that it's a 12-year-old who didn't want to be in Sunday school. They took the pencil like this. So, this theological education as mission endeavor is that we share this in common. We want to proclaim or help proclaim Jesus Christ in word and in deed. In word, we talked a little bit about that yesterday in terms of what would solidarity look like, how difficult it is to imagine oneself into a position of solidarity in a culture that is not one's own. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this and I hope learn from you all with this. It's not really well organized, but take heart. If in 2 or 3 years, as I hope, there's a book that I've edited from missionary professors around the world, you'll know that you were on the beginning of it. In word, when I walked into the seminary classroom, even though my first full-time teaching post was at a Methodist seminary, and I was a Lutheran who had once been a Missouri City Lutheran. Scary, huh? I could assume at least common text, being a Hebrew Bible professor. Pretty much common tradition that with the Methodism is really cool because John Wesley had his Enlightenment experience while reading Luther's preface to the preface to Luther's commentary on Romans. So we knew that the Methodists at least had to know who Luther was. And shared hopes. Some kind of eschatological hope, whether it be a physical resurrection in the more traditional churches or some kind of spiritual resurrection. Reading those texts, especially the Pauline text and the Book of Revelations, more metaphorical, allegorical terms. But we have some hope that pushes us forward. It's not just about here and now that is important, but there's also something out there. Some of the things, so that's something that we all, everybody that asks, Escuela Superior de Teología, where I taught for 8 years, like at Garrett Evangelical, where I taught for 11 years before going to Brazil, everybody was some kind of a Christian. Everybody believed in Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. Everyone tried to live it out in a variety of ways in conformity with his or her context. And probably had more, for me, probably had more diversity on the Garrett faculty than I had on the Est faculty. Because Garrett was quite an interesting place in that regard. But in any of these, and these are the, I put these out, I must have forgotten some of them. Because I only got four continents here. Asia, North America. Australia. Well, if we have anybody there, we must have somebody there. Let's kind of put them into the North American Asian part. Europe is good Lord. Has my mind been colonized or what? We'll fill that in later. The different contexts means a lot of different things. We talked about some of that yesterday. I ended with a joke about understanding culture. How do you get a Brazilian to jump in the lake? You tell him he can't. It's all against the law, and then he's going to find a way to do it. Different icons, different symbols. I don't know what the drive. Well, no, unfortunately, I've already said this before. I'm not pleased that I see so many American, U.S. flags flying wherever I go. I'm home these days. Not because I have anything against the U.S. flag or the United States. I don't like the way we are acting in the world today. The U.S. flag has always been an important icon for U.S. citizens and always should be, I think. The Brazilian flag is an important icon for all Brazilians, for most Brazilian citizens. And as we look up here in front of the Village Center, we see lots of different flags, and we need to understand that their context, their icons are as important to us, to them, and should be as important to us when we are visitors, as we would expect someone to be respectful of the U.S. flag if they were visiting here. And that's something that it's taken us a while to get to this point. And it took me a while to take off some of my, set down some of my U.S. baggage when I got to Brazil. Mm-hmm. The icons and with the icons, the metaphors, how do you say things, both in the broad sense of just what language are we using? Just a quick, just a couple of funny things about language. Richard Wangen, somebody here, I don't know if the person is still here, is here again today, but Dick and Dorothy Wangen were missionaries in Brazil. They've been there for almost 50 years now, 47 years, I guess, they've been in now. He is a fervid peacemaker. He refers to himself as a militant for peace. Mm-hmm. And I go, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. You can't put military and peace in the same phrase. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work for me. It works for every person. They don't, militant doesn't mean militate in the same sense that it does in American English, or the sense that I use. If you speak some Spanish, you know the word esquisito. It's very similar to exquisite. Mm-hmm. One of a kind, you walk in, so what an exquisite buffet. Yeah? If you say esquisito in Brazilian Portuguese, you're saying kind of weird. It's one of a kind. It's unique. Yeah? So you have to be careful how you speak, what images you use, and where you go. So some things that would be that we could never do in English, some images that we could never use in American English, U.S. English, they flow quite freely for Brazilians and for Asians, others for Asians and others for Latin Americans, and I imagine others for Europeans. And in the same way, they say things that just like hit me upside the head. I mentioned a militant for peace. And it's sort of oxymoron, like military intelligence. So when we get into the theological world, theological concepts, how do we make the transference? What we've tended to do is take these as sort of an imagined center and impulse of Christianity out into the world, and we've, the Germans have until quite recently thought of theology as an export commodity. We do the best theology in the world in Germany, and of course everybody wants to know Buchmann, Bart, Bart was Swiss, Buchmann, Tillich, you name them, most of them, Pannenberg, driven right out of my head now. But at any rate, the Germans were the ones who did theology. My students, my colleagues down in South America, almost all of them had gone back to Germany, gone to Germany, and actually kind of said back to Germany where grandma had come from, or grandma and grandpa had come from, to get sort of re-Germanized in a cultural sense, but more importantly, in this case, in a theological sense. To learn how real theology is done, not this practical stuff that we do in Latin America, not this practical stuff that we do in North America, but real cerebral philosophical theology. These common texts, common traditions, common hopes, which we have have presumed was the case, that could be exported to various places. For the last 40, 50 years, the last 100 years, really started with American philosophical rebellion, when we actually started trying to do our own philosophy in the United States. But in theology, it came a little later, in the insistence on black theology, insistence on feminist theology, insistence on Latino theology, more recently gay and lesbian transgender theologies, queer theology, they quite probably call it. became the insistence that we understand that everybody does theology from a context. And the first wave was they're doing theology for their context, we're doing theology for everybody because we are at the center, like this fireplace here, former fireplace. We are at the center doing theology for everybody. And theirs is off here on the margin. Queer theology, I'm not even sure it's Christian because, you know, I am sure not everybody in the center who considers himself in the center would say that, but many would say that feminism is on the margin because it disrupts the normal order of family structure. Yeah, you're kind of not. I actually heard that in the classroom.
You mean in the sense of wanting to refer to God not as masculine, but...
That's another part of the issue. No, I mean in the sense that you and I meet each other, mm-hmm. we fall in love, and I'm the man and you're the woman, and so you do as I say. Mm-hmm. Right?
That's right.
Yeah. these younger folk, they can't even imagine a world. I don't know, I'm speaking for you. Can you imagine falling in love with a man who would treat you as less than equal? And of course, there are different ways of explaining it, but the part that I was talking about is that when she says, I'm going to go to work 6 weeks after the baby's born, or maybe the day after the baby is born, and you're going to have to do more work in the house and watch less football and, you know, maybe cut back at your real work so I can go to my real work, that disrupts the family. Because the natural order of things is for young women to stay home and raise children. Now, that's what we think. But it hasn't always been the normal order of things. It's our Northern European, Northern Atlantic common traditions that say that. And we've been lucky enough in many cases when that could happen when it was the desired thing. But there have been generations of women who have been kind of socially pressurized into doing things that they didn't want to do, not doing things that they wanted to do. Last week we had a doctor here, a couple, both were physicians, and we're talking about the changes in medical education in the United States, and thank God we're not going to have any more 36-hour residencies, 36-hour stretches for residents as of this month. They're no longer legal. I don't want a resident who's been away for 32 hours. But can have an emergency service. It's complicated enough as it is. And we got talking about the nursing shortage, and she said, yeah, all those women who should have been nurses who are doctors now. And she was being sarcastic. upset the natural order of things. You know, when I was a kid, boys were doctors and girls were nurses. You know, now boys are nurses, and girls are nurses, and girls are doctors, and boys are doctors. You know, so this, the naturalness of this stuff, and all of, in every one of these, I'm not trying to make us out to be the bad guys in this. I'm just saying that every one of these structures, every one of these places has a variety of social structures, social constructs that they have learned to deal with in their context that makes theological education a different endeavor. I think I gave the example yesterday of trying to teach about power structures as they're represented in the Hebrew Bible. Maybe closely not raised through that. In a culture that lives with, I am fairly certain, in Latin America, nobody wanted to be outside of the structure. Mm. We don't need structure. I'm fairly certain if I tried to teach the same class and did the same exercise in Asia, everybody would want to be outside of structure because most Asian societies are really quite highly structured. The first thing they do, businessmen from Asia do when they get together is find out who is the oldest so they know who bows to whom. Mm. You know, they exchange their cards and they talk about birth dates and then you know who got at least the titular head is because he is the eldest and respect for elders is tantamount in most Asian cultures. And that's when you see the jokes in the movies about how do you know to whom to bow. That's part of the reason. confusion of who's first of all, who's culture, and then how do we find out how to do them? What are the rules within them? Businesses, there's a business that's burgeoned just in telling people how to do business in other cultures. Let me just see if there are questions or if I've said anything of note or that needs clarification up until now.
Here, I'm interested in, but I don't want to stray from your topic so much, but I'm interested in your, how you view theological education in light of the history of colonization and like this missionary conquest history that we carry with us as North Americans, and how you think about that, especially when you're doing it in foreign contexts. And we might not have time to do that now, but I'm interested to hear you speak.
I want to do some of that. You can see some of this stuff is on the board.
Yeah.
But anything that I've done up until now? Let me just jump right into that. It's actually one of the first things that came to mind. And note that there are lots of different things that happened here. I didn't put African traditional religions here. And it's a surprise to most North Americans. African traditional religions still exist in North America and the Caribbean. Islam is really strong. Other influence in both Africa, Asia and Africa. An acquaintance of mine, well, my best friend in the world is ABC, American Born Chinese, and we met at seminary. Great story, my kids love to tell, so I have to tell it. I met him on the first day of seminary, our first day here at the seminary from San Francisco out of New Jersey, and I came from this little Midwestern Lutheran set of colleges, and I saw him with all this junk. I thought about this beat up Volkswagen Beetle. I said, "Can I help you with your bags?" And he looked at me and kind of, "I don't believe this." And he said, "Yeah, sure, if I can do your shirts." We've been like this. I crossed oceans across the continent for 27 years now. That was one of the funniest comebacks I ever heard. And Andy was very helpful in my understanding that within the United States, if you grew up in San Francisco, if you grew up on the West Coast, if you grew up in New York, near Chinatown, a city that has a sizable population, you understand that there is a culture there. If you grew up in Saginaw, Michigan, you don't even know if there's culture in Saginaw, Michigan. But certainly that the Chinese culture and the Japanese culture, and that they make a distinction, my goodness, you know. With Andy again, I was 23 years old, 24 years old, and he said something about a Japanese person, and I said, "Well, how can you tell?" It's a wrong question. But that there are ancient textual, religious, and cultural practices. Andy and Karen, and they take their 8-year-old now. What's today? No, tomorrow. Tomorrow is their twins' 8th birthday. I know you want to know that detail. They will take them sometime this week to the cemetery to remind them of who their ancestors are. Kind of an ancestor worship, which we're not very comfortable with in the modern West, except when it's a famous guy or gal. If you've seen the movie Amistad, where Anthony Hopkins is an American, has that great thing. He learns from the African about the importance of the ancestors and where the ancestors were guiding us. And he makes the same switch talking about the founding fathers of the United States and how they gave us a tradition that we must follow, should follow, want to follow, want to enliven. Well, Asians do that. Africans do that. Many Latin Americans do that, especially if they're African descendants, but also the indigenous people. A thing that scared the missionaries at first, frightened us, that we've got this ancestor worship out there, and these people believe that their spirits are everywhere. And then we invite them in communion and talk about the fellowship of the saints, all who have gone before us and who will come after us, and who are gathered all over the world in this very common table. So it's all right if you do it. with our icons and our metaphors, but mm-hmm. you can't do it with yours. Mm-hmm. I teach text, and most of the church believes in the Old and the New Testament. I've found since I've made the choice to become an Old Testament professor that much of the church really only believes in the New Testament. Mm. Which, as far as I know, no Christian church said, well, there are some Foursquare Gospel type churches that are New Testament churches, but every church of the mainline, almost every church of the evangelical sort, talks about being in their constituting documents, in the normative document, talk about being a church of the Old and the New Testament. Fine. How do you read an ancient text?
Well, we read it in translation.
Most of us read it in translation. So you already got to trust somebody goofy like me. That's what I always tell my Hebrew students, study hard. Otherwise, you have to trust me for the rest of your life. Mm. That's to know, or someone like me, to know what the text is really saying. What else do we do in order to study ancient texts, to read ancient religious texts?
History
of the period when the text was written. History of the transmission of the text. Mm. Who edited it? Where was it used? What was its various contexts along the way? We assume in Europe and the United States that the text of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament came through the Roman Catholic Church into the Protestant tradition and is therefore in sort of a direct line into our cultural milieu. Jim Hansen used that word last week and laughed about it, and I found myself using it for the first time in 100 years. We kind of see it as a direct line, as we are cultural inheritors of that scriptural tradition. And kind of accept that if you want this in Africa, you've got to come through Europe or the United States. If you want this in Asia, you've got to come through Europe or the United States. If you want this in Latin America, you have to come through Europe or the United States to get at it. Archie Lee, who is he's either Oxford educated and taught at Cambridge or Cambridge educated and taught at Oxford, Chinese-born Chinese man, teaching now at the Hong Kong University, which, guess what, it's in Hong Kong, wants us to remember and keeps hammering away at every Westerner who gets a chance to talk to, that the Chinese have a tradition of reading text that is older than ours. He says, when we are studying how one reads ancient text in a different way. Mm-hmm. So there's one very concrete difference in the way Archie teaches his, he's also an Old Testament professor, teaches his students Hebrew Bible based on the other traditions that they have as textual traditions, both cultural and religious traditions.
And is that also true of the Coptic tradition?
It's also true in Africa, in the Coptic Church and the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Some people will tell you that the Ethiopian Orthodox Church came as a missionary endeavor in the 4th century from the Coptic, Coptic Church. Others will say it has other origins. But at any rate, 4th century in Ethiopia, before that in the Coptic tradition, in Egypt, make that Christian tradition older than anything we have in Rome. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try to get through to my students. In the Reconquista, Christianity went to parts of Africa where it hadn't been before, but the Europeans didn't take Christianity to Africa because it was already there. In fact, Jesus went directly to Africa when he was a baby. We all tell the story. Here he wants to kill all the babies. Where do they go to hide? Africa. So there's a living African tradition of Christ's presence there. You can go to Cairo and see the church built on the site where he was hidden, you know,
okay.
And so there are different traditions. So these kinds of things, you know, having been able to go to that church site in Kaidan, having been able to meet with Archie Lee, having a product of U.S. Chinese mission. If you've been to San Francisco, you might know Cameron House Presbyterian Mission in Chinatown, where it was a mission endeavor in the U.S. for Chinese immigrants. That's where Andy grew up. I get a little sense of the Asian side, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Having been here, studying some of this stuff as part of my background and having some chances to visit, can speak fairly freely and I hope with some eloquence about, at least from time to time, about these ancient societal structures, vivid oral traditions. I put down here common text, and I put down common traditions. We tend to lean on the text side up here and forget about the traditional side. It's not written down, or some lawyer hasn't signed it. It's not really real often in the United States. If it's not in some civil code in Europe, somewhere along the line, or some decree by one of the monarchs back when a monarch still had power, or the Constitution, doesn't really count. In some of these societies, what it said still has a lot of weight. One of the differences here in Africa, I just want to mention human memory. It's becoming clearer and clearer that most of human memory in one form or another is in Africa, I mean, where we came from. DNA mapping that's being done now indicates that every time something comes up, the monogenesis theory, which is, the, you know, we all came from the same place, sort of genesis, kind of funny to go back to that. And that we came out of Africa. And the most recent theory that I've heard is about 80,000 before present. We all came out, and a small group came out about 35,000 years later. The world was populated. DNA mapping shows that they all came out of this group that came out of Ethiopia, across it to Yemen, spread out through Asia and up into Africa, the first surviving group. And that group is the group that we all, that the surviving group, we all have enough, all of us outside of Africa have enough DNA, mitochondrial DNA in common to illustrate that we come from the same maternal groups. All of human diversity is present in Africa. All genetic diversity among humans is present in Africa. In Africa, in Asia, to a lesser extent, in a different form, we have desperate physical needs. Health, nutrition, and it's sort of like here, kind of double, triple recovery. First they were colonized, then they have dictatorships, and now they have somewhat democratic republics in both Latin America and Africa. But they've got this terrible graft problem. You know, part of it is the way that we have done aid, both as churches and as government. There are people who can talk much more eloquently about that, but as long as we continue to cite development in terms of gross national product, and not in terms of how it gets spread around among the people. Mm. I mean, if the gross national product goes through the roof, as it does from time to time in certain areas of the United States, but it all goes to, let's say, the Microsoft employees, and the former Boeing employees get none of it, well, then we still have, you know, first world and near third world conditions that exist side by side. And Brazil is often referred to as Bell India, because once South Africa regulated itself with the new South Africa, Brazil took over as the country with the largest separation between the richest of the rich and the poorest. Extreme misery in Africa and in Latin America. colonization, military dictatorship, and graft. And dictatorships were always with some kind of foreign intervention, usually as some sort of Cold War puppet with either the United States or the Soviet Union supporting the military dictatorships. So another thing that we can look back on, colonization, the end of colonization is a long, slow process, because here the graft is in large part created by the policies of the IMF and the World Bank, which count just how much you produce and not how you distribute the wealth among the people. So all of these things together, the one thing I haven't touched on is the other religions. All of these things together make for an interesting soup when you get into the theological education. We talked a little bit yesterday about how theological education is a matter of power, learning the right language to get in the right door to get to the right person, who then will help you do whatever it is you want to do, whether it's a great thing or a personally greedy thing. It seems not to make a difference. You've got to go through the right door to get there. So images that might be really meaningful here. Fall flat. Or they might be really good. I bet this affluenza, this catchy tie-level book that's in the bookstore, we just got too much stuff and we're kind of sick from it. If the image comes out of this cross-section of the sector of the U.S. society and then goes directly to this, the parallel part of the Brazilian or African or Asian society, because what's happening is that we're not dividing the world into third world, first world, second world anymore. What's happening more and more is that in the United States we have pockets of the third world. And in Brazil, we have huge pockets of the third world and very large pockets of the first world. So I turn on my internet service in Brazil and said, buy your stuff in the U.S. without paying the import tax. So it's people who can afford the internet are also the people who can, buy a computer, buy the newest Sony, whatever it is, the $200 basketball shoes, all that sort of stuff. So the first and third world are not regionalized anymore, but they're pockets in different places. So this might translate. Yesterday, before, somebody asked about the growth of the neo-Pentecostal churches, and unfortunately a lot of the neo-Pentecostal churches in Brazil and Asia and Africa and the United States are churches of what Lutherans call churches of glory. Sort of the Tammy Faye, James Baker. Yeah, I'm a child of the king, so I should live like a prince. Mm-hmm. Sort of theology, and so the idea of solidarity with my neighbor doesn't enter in, because that's God's business. I'm all right with God, and so I'm doing okay. Mm-hmm. There must be some problem if you're not doing all right. I'll help you figure out what it is, but I'm not going to help you out by feeding you. That's God's job. I think there's more. One of the things I hope to do in the next 10 years, assuming continued good health and possibilities that I've had so far, is to try to organize, especially for African Americans, trips and exchange programs with Afro-Brazilians, because the colonization and class structures are not, they're different, but they're not that different. What African Americans have tended to do is to want to go to Africa and recover roots. But we went through different processes. They were colonized in their own land, we were brought someplace into a colonial structure that then threw off the colony, but then became a colonial power. And the Latin Americans, to some extent, did the same thing. So how do we fit? To me, it makes more sense to talk, in this sense, north-south than to go north to south-east. Any questions or observations, clarifications?
You talked about extreme poverty and rebellious and so on. What is happening in terms of missions and bringing Christian church to that group of people?
To the extremely poor?
Yeah.
There are lots of things that are happening. I can speak most about Brazil, where I had most experience. This is unfortunately not a high priority for Lutheran churches so far, because in part I think because Brazil is sort of off the list of third world countries.
Mm-hmm.
Because so many people make so much money, the gross national product is up there. They are producing, my brother works on stocks, bonds, something, futures. Okay? And Brazil has been on his list of emerging countries for about 5-6 years now. So it's not perceived, where the need is desperate, is not perceived in the same way that it is in Africa. The ELCA at this moment, I don't know what their plans are for the near future, but at this moment the ELCA has one missionary family in Brazil now. In the 60s they had 40.
Mm-hmm.
The IECLB is working hard to cease to be such an inward-looking church for Germanic descendant people, and sees itself still as a mission recipient rather than a mission church in general. There is a center for mission work. That sort of formed as a parallel structure to the, or actually a competitive structure, now has become a partner with the main institution of theological education. There is something called Missão Zero. I think it was supposed to be by 2000, we were going to have significant missionary endeavors out of our church in the interior of Brazil, in places where we don't typically go. Theologically, it wasn't to my taste. We couldn't have worked very well together. But this is the group that has done the most in terms of going out to the very poor, going out to the people who have been basically disenfranchised in one way or another in Brazilian society, and inviting them into a Lutheran church. They were not liberation theologians. The center where I taught was trying to find its soul after being the center of liberation theology in the present. Liberation theology in Latin America 30 years ago, and had sort of lost that direction.
Yeah.
And so they were at odds for a long time. They're starting to talk to each other.
Just one more step on this. Where physically do the missionaries go, and where is the Lutheran church? Are they among the very, very poor, or are they among the affluent and...
It's kind of a mix, and it depends on where you go. In theological education, when you talk about, which I listed for the topic today, you're basically set up for going to a fairly affluent, I mean somebody who can afford to get from hometown to a theological center. Stay at a theological center for somewhere between 4 and 10 years if they go all the way through the doctoral program. Somebody's got to have some money. It may not be their own money, may not be their family's money, but it's somebody's putting a fair amount of money into that person's education. The ELCA has been very active in theological education around the world for the last 20, 30, 40 years. Tanzania, strong influence there. Hong Kong, very strong. Philippines, very strong presence. Latin America, strong presence in Brazil, and a fairly strong presence in Argentina. The other really good, in that case, interdenominational seminary. Let me just say a word about my students there, kind of help you understand how poor many of them, or not all of them, but most of them come from small farms that in the United States would have closed down in the 1970s during the farm crisis, if they were even big enough to be affected by the farm crisis. They're basically subsistence farmers where their parents make in terms of, they make enough to eat, but in terms of producing income, they make somewhere between $100 and $200 a month in income. So that family paying school fees is out of the question if they don't have help from the church. So, and making $200 a year, a month in Brazil sounds, you know, desperate, and it is, you know, it's hard for them to live on that, but it's not like trying to live on $200 a month in the United States. You just can't do it.
But the objective is that if in Brazil or wherever you go, that the theological leadership, the cultural leadership, can come from, that they can be educated and trained and helped, but we won't be sending missionaries.
Exactly.
That what we could do is help them evolve into a stronger society with their own people.
Mm-hmm. And it's a long process. But that is precisely the point. There's one, as I mentioned, one ELCA missionary left now in Brazil. Oh, she teaches Hebrew, and he is the librarian. And there was a real, real dicey moment when contract renewals with DGM and the missionary and the seminary came up, and the then head of mission for Latin America said, "This man is very valuable." You know, he actually points to theology professors. We got tons of them. We got them all over the place. But theological librarians, there are almost none, and needed all over Latin America, and needed all over the world. The people who can help organize a growing library and know how to purchase and how to beg, borrow, and steal books to build a library. And he actually wasn't intended to be a threat, but he said, "Yeah, we're thinking about moving Alan to another spot." Alan had no desire to move. But what had happened is Germano, who had been one of my students when I was teaching at Garrett, had finished his master's in theology, had finished his master's in library science, and had gone back and was the associate and then the librarian with Alan. Alan wanted to do that technology and then got moved. And so there was, when he was the technology guy, there was a problem because ELCA knew they had a library guy that was sort of available because Alan had sort of worked himself out of a job. And that's what we all want to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to do. There are places where people need to stay longer. Yeah.
Do the students tend to stay in Brazil?
Our students, yeah, stay in Brazil. Almost all of them. And that's another good thing about doing a theological education in country. If you send somebody to Europe, once somebody's gone to Europe to get a doctorate or a master's, or to the United States and seen the just piles of stuff that we have, see and compares that to what they will have after 30, 40 years of hard work in Brazil, it's hard not to wonder would it be better to stay in the States. At Garrett, we had a huge problem. The Chicago area was just filling up with Korean Christians, you know, which in and of itself is not a problem. But about half of those came with the promise of going back to Korea and being pastors and teachers there. But because of the move for diversity, because of the growing business community in Chicago, there were Korean, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran churches popping up all over the place in Chicago in the 1980s. And that was, how do you bring somebody to dinner and say, "Yeah, eat what you want, but don't eat that"? Mm-hmm. And that's how the United States was built. And for better or worse, that's who we are. This kind of gets onto the edge of maybe a part of your question. John Lamond at the meeting last year when I was pressing for indigenization of theology, mm-hmm. of theologies, so that we're not teaching, as I said, Lenny Barber Tillich, just the way we learned it when we were in seminary 20, 30 years ago. said, well, what if they want part three? Mm-hmm. You know? And they do. I mean, everybody wants to be part of the conversation. And it's difficult to be a part of the Christian conversation or the Christian conversations if you don't know Bart and you don't know Tiller. You haven't been at least acquainted with Bart and Tiller, Schleiermacher, and Feuerbach, and all those other great German names. And then a few North American names that you got to know, like Stanley Hauerwas and James Cone and Cornel West. If you don't know these names, you don't participate in the main conversation. You also have to know, this was one of the problems, is you had to know, for a while you had to know all these names, and you had to know Leonardo Boff and John Sobrino and Juan Luis Segundo. You know, so you learn real theology, and then you learn Latin American theology. You learn real theology, and then you learn Black theology. You learn real theology, and then you learn feminist theology. Now the process is happening in such a way that nobody is going to say that Rosemary Ruther, for example, is not one of the outstanding theologians of the 20th century. She's, you know, not feminist theologians, one of the outstanding theologians of the 20th century. No one's going to say that James Cone is not one of the outstanding theologians, not one of the outstanding Black theologians, which he is, the preeminent Black theologian in the United States, but he is one of the outstanding theologians in the 20th century, no matter where you do theology. And so that's sometimes kind of hard to convince some people who think that, no, I've got to learn just the Germans. Yeah? Or I've got to learn the Germans and the U.S. folk and the Germans and the Brits and those few French who wrote philosophy that was then moved into the theological fields like, who are those French people? Derrida and Foucault, and Questions of Power, Deconstruction. We're going to do this much here, maybe by time blocks, or maybe by lines of thought, who touches in lines of thought, but we're not going to talk about it as if what happened in Europe is real and what happens in your country is secondary, which is the way that the colonized mind continues to work in ignorance.
Sounds a lot teaching history, you know, which was my field.
Well,
and that history was what happened to the, you know, to our line, and we hardly know what happened in the other parts of the world. We aren't interested in it. And we're completely ignorant about it.
Yeah. But what was happening was history was what happened in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And only what happened in Europe that got us to us.
Mm-hmm.
And not what got us to us, but what got us to the leaders of our country.
Mm-hmm.
The leaders of our theological movement. So that for a long time, they're just starting to talk about what was happening in theological education in Brazil in the 30s and 40s. And I mentioned the other day that only because of some U.S. intervention, only because of some very strong leadership, did the Brazilian Lutheran churches not follow the Lutheran churches in Germany, but align themselves with the confessing churches. With the confessing church. It was by that much, because of the strong Germanic heritage, that they were going to be a German, a typical German church. And actually, Brazil initially decided, a German descendant president at the time, initially sided with the Germans in World War II.
Mm.
So, you know, and again, go back to the same, we are the Germans, you know, we are German descendants, but but, you know, the part of Germany that you talk about is in Poland now. The dialect of German that you speak from over by the Rhineland, nobody speaks that anymore. Germany is the Germany that your ancestors left doesn't exist anymore. What you're remembering is a piece of history, but you're forgetting. You know, I hear these stories in private about people who ran away from the basically feudal lord, jumped on the first ship leaving, and that's why they're in Brazil. I hear those stories in private, but the public story is we are a great and noble people. You know? I'm trying to remember where this happened a couple weeks ago. I was doing a workshop for one of the synods just a few weeks before I left. And I really pushed them on this question of who came from Germany to Brazil. I pushed just a little bit harder than polite. Not far beyond polite. It was, okay, yeah, we were the dregs of society. Yeah. Mm. When we do the same thing in ISIS, we talk about history, we talk about the Virginia nobleman, yeah, and we forget that the Irish and most of the Germans, the first Germans that came to the United States were people who were conscripted, basically kidnapped off the street by their Hessian lords and rented to the British. And when the war was over and the British went, they didn't have to go home to that crap, and they chose to stay here. That's not very close to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. Swedes, Danes, Norwegians. I preached at the church that I belonged to for most of my adult life in Chicago. It's predominantly Swedish Lutheran. And I was talking to the pastor once about my grandmother, who was a maid and a cook in a wealthy home back in Michigan. And told the story, for some reason I flouted up or something, and he thought it was cool. He said, you ought to talk to some of the older members here. Said, because almost every one of our oldest Swedish members came over from Sweden at 18, 20 years old and worked as a domestic in some rich house in Chicago. We remember our Swedish heritage in that congregation, but we don't very often talk publicly about who we are, what our humble beginnings are. And when we do talk about them, there are always things to be overcome rather than, why is it that the Israelites couldn't have slaves? Well, because you were once slaves. So you have to be in solidarity with anybody who's in that position. You can't put somebody in that position. Sort of wandering away here, but I, this is sort of on target with that, answer that first question. We try not to, but in some ways we get down the road and we realize we've done it again.
Mm-hmm.
We've walked down the road and we realized, when I realized what happened in my mission assignment, I started joking about it because there was nothing left to do. Mm-hmm. But two guys who had worked their way up through the Lutheran system had an idea about what was needed in another Lutheran church, another part of the Lutheran World Federation, because they'd seen it, they'd been there, and they decided to send me to fix a problem. Mm-hmm. Over there, to make them more like our church. So we're as the ELC is racing towards 4% inclusion. We kind of missed the 1997 10% goal that we set when the new church was formed. But we're racing towards 4% of all ethnic minorities not from Europe. The church in Brazil is just, they're not even half as good as us. They're racing toward 2%. Yeah? And so they sent me down there to kind of give it a kickstart so that they would be more like Will and Raphael's vision of the Lutheran Church in the American context. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the touchy items for me. I, a long time ago, finishing college, had a girlfriend who was very involved in Hispanic ministries. And she went down to work on the Rio Grande border. And then she went to work for a year in Guatemala. And she took Marlo Thomas's Freedom Be You, Freedom Be Me book. You guys remember that?
Yeah.
And I said, how can you do that? You who love Hispanic, I mean, we weren't very sophisticated yet, Guatemalan, what's Guatemalan? But you who love the Spanish language, Castellano, who love this culture that enlivens and invigorates you so much, And you're taking U.S. feminism down there to a culture where a woman without a man has nothing. I'm not saying she didn't do the right thing. I just didn't understand how to do it. And we don't know how to do it. Because we always, whichever one of these we are, Christina's not, but she mentioned that, and I put it up here today, that North America is a mission field.
Mm-hmm.
We might be offended by that, but they're just as offended often by us coming down and telling them what to do. This affluenza, these colonial class structures, graft and greed, that is not just a U.S. problem, because when it happens in the U.S., it happens all over the world, because there aren't any U.S. companies. There are very few U.S. companies left. These multinationals, when they cheat us out of billions, they're cheating hundreds of millions in South America and billions in Africa, in the same way that they're cheating us. So these guys want to come over here and teach us a thing or two about solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
Their idea of solidarity doesn't work very well here. Our idea of individuality doesn't work very well here. And so we're still, for all of the acceptance that no matter, maybe some people, well, I guess two or three people are brighter than me, but so maybe some people do it better than I do, but I kept finding this, no matter how aware I became of my U.S.-ness, becoming a white male in the third world, I still stumbled all over it, because I don't know how not to think like me, out of my context. And so what makes sense to me, out of my context, even knowing well this context, meant that I stumbled all over myself and did some things that were pretty imperialist. And the only thing I can say about that is thank God that there's grace even for that. And the Brazilian people, to me, were very gracious in that. I'm already over time. Just to kind of try to recapitulate, in the theological education endeavor, this is pretty much the case. We're all Christians trying to find ways to be faithful in word and in deed to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. We can, within the church, assume some common tests and some common traditions and shared hopes, but all of these differences here mean that we have to look at all this stuff from different angles, from a lot of different angles. It's not just this axis anymore that determines what these common texts mean and how they can and should be read, being read in a lot of different ways. And I think that will eventually enrich the way we do theology in the United States, the more we hear these stories, understand these contexts, and see them blended with other traditions other than our own. And that was a real opportunity for me to be able to share it in a somewhat more organized fashion as we go on the road. So that's it for me for holding this time. Thanks for your attention.